The job of the blender is to combine these elements in such a way as to produce an overall flavour.
A wider repertoire of different beverages than ever before.
I think one of the most interesting breweries, and certainly one of the most interesting origin stories for a brewery in Australia.
Single malts, blends, grain whiskies, bourbons and more.
If you want mezcal to be sold around the world, then unfortunately you're going to have to make a compromise.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson. And this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. Matt Kierkegaard probably doesn't require an introduction for many of you. But just in case, Matt is a veteran beer writer and founder of the beer industry publication Brews News, which I edited for a few years prior to starting Drinks Adventures. His podcast, Radio Brews News, is Australia's longest-running beer podcast, with an archive of 644 episodes at the time of writing. Matt's never short of an opinion, so following a particularly eventful year in the beer industry, I figured I was long overdue to invite him on for a chat. Coming up for you in this episode, Matt and I discuss the booming non-alcoholic beer segment. But is it really booming? We cover the recent trend of breweries raising capital by way of equity crowdfunding with mixed results. And in fact, since we recorded this conversation, Gold Coast outfit Black Hops has completed its latest raise, which at $2.2 million is the largest ever campaign by an Australian brewery. Also on the agenda is the latest trademark dispute between Australian breweries and whether the legendary West Australian company, Feral Brewing, is damaged goods after being listed for sale by Coca-Cola Euro-Pacific Partners. And in a related discussion, we consider in retrospect the wisdom of Coke naming a craft beer brand after an obscure country town that no one visits. Matt also fills us in on recent projects at Brews News, including its efforts to find out how many breweries there are really in Australia. That's all coming up in just a moment. Well, Matt Kierkegaard, great to finally have you with me on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
Mate, I'm thrilled. Thank you very much for asking me. It's a bit of a turnaround.
Well, I think technically speaking, this is your third appearance because I did speak to you for the Stone and Wood documentary and then the Chuck Hahn one last year. So I think that makes you a technical friend of the show.
and congratulations again. Like, you know, this is going to be one of those chats where I actually quote you back to you a couple of times. But congratulations on both of those podcasts. You know, again, it's been next level in terms of anything in the space. So you've deservedly been well praised for them.
Thanks, mate. Well, every time I, you know, read one of the major papers online or the broadsheets of this world, I keep getting told that non-alcoholic beer is absolutely booming. And, you know, we saw in the last few months Heaps Normal did a capital raising that valued the company at a significant sum. I can't quite remember exactly what it was.
$57 million or something like that?
Right. And but I know you're pretty skeptical of the long term future of this category. Maybe you could talk to why that
yeah,
is.
Yeah, and I have to start by saying I actually love zero alk and ultra low alk beer. You know, it's such a great innovation, and it really has a role. I guess the reason that I'm perceived as being a little bit bearish on it is because when you look at the unparalleled level of hype and media coverage that it's received, they've conflated some trends, you know, with potential for the market. You know, you've got media that thrives on alcohol advertising, seeing a decline in alcohol, you know, and so they're reporting on stories and quoting businesses that are selling the product for support for the potential of the market, when those same businesses are, as you highlighted, going out to equity markets for raising. You know, when you step back from the self-interest involved in self-promotion of that, what is the market? And one of the things that people regularly raise as a reason that alcohol-free anything has a future is there is a generation of, you know, millennials or whatever the generation is, who are the 18 to 25s, who are consciously consuming less alcohol, as if that same group are going to automatically look for non-alcoholic versions of traditional alcoholic products. And many of us can remember, you know, our first taste of beer as, you know, probably 16, 17, 18 year olds, if we're honest, but certainly young drinkers. Where
I wasn't drinking it because I enjoyed it.
No,
sure.
It was
the first time I had it.
Yeah, and that was exactly it. And as, you know, one of my good friends, you know, sums it up, you know, your dad said, you know, don't worry, son, it's an acquired taste, but it's a taste worth acquiring. And that was the cultural pressure that we had because we were consuming alcohol. Now, with the wider variety of Canadian clubs or, you know, sweeter pre-mixed drinks that you don't taste the alcohol really, there's no bitterness, you know, so they're basically soft drinks. Young drinkers aren't having the reason to acquire that beer palate because they can get alcohol in other forms. So for the beer industry, if I'm not drinking alcohol, what is my incentive to normalize the flavors that we know a lot of people don't actually like? There is a very powerful use case for people who want to go out and, you know, socialize and have a session but don't necessarily want to have 5 or 6 alcoholic beers over that period. So they're substituting part of their repertoire for alcohol-free in beer. And it also means that you can stand there with a beer and not necessarily be grilled, oh, mate, you're on the waters or something like that. You've got that pretense.
Social camouflage, yeah. I think the marketers call it.
Great term. I hadn't actually heard that, but that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Complete abstainers aren't going, oh, you beauty, I can indulge in a beer now because, you know, I love the taste of it. When the challenge is they don't acquire the taste for it, then whilst it's a really, really valuable addition to the beer space, this idea that, you know, X percent, you know,
15% of the market is going to be non-alcoholic.
Yeah, so then you also look at the places where it is starting to get that level of penetration are places like Germany, which doesn't have a mid-strength market at all. The Czech Republic that has an absolute zero drink driving, you know, you can't drive with any alcohol in your system, not just on your P's. Those sorts of businesses, you know, those sorts of countries where they don't have a mid-strength market are looking at, but have an appreciation, a cultural appreciation for the flavors of beer. They have a reason that I can understand why it would just be consumed much more broadly. In Australia, we pioneered the mid-strength beer market back in the 80s. 4X Gold, which was at one time one of the biggest brands in the country, was only first brewed in 1992. Mid-strength got to about 20% of the beer market here, but the reasons that drove that don't necessarily transfer to the alcohol-free because we do have a strong culture of mid-strength beer. So, yeah, look, I love it as a category. Brewers have made some amazing examples and they've really come ahead leaps and bounds in making alcohol-free beer a drink that beer drinkers can really substitute into. But this idea that, you know, anyone that wants to avoid alcohol in the beer industry will embrace it, I just need to be convinced about that.
Yeah, I mean, I actually recently tasted the Sidewinder XPA. Brick Lane were good enough to send me a 4-pack of that, and I think it's an excellent
100%,
beer.
100%, like, yeah.
It's an absolute cracker, and I've drunk every single one of the 4 they sent me because I've actually been off the booze for the last few months. For the last few weeks, not months. Important clarification. But I never find myself wanting to have a second one so much. I feel like if I have one at the end of the day, it's like that kind of one knockoff beverage that is very similar to a, you know, to a good craft beer. But there's something about the non-alcs for me that I wouldn't really session on them so much. It might be a bit different if I was at a picnic or a barbecue, you know, where I was more actively socializing, you know what I mean, and kind of wanted to just to have another beer and kind of feel like I was part of the occasion a bit more. But I don't know whether they're ever going to sort of replace alcoholic beers in terms of volume.
And that's the thing. As I said, you know, when you finish mowing the lawn, you know, that old trope of finishing mowing the lawn, it's not the alcohol that you're necessarily craving. It's that, you know, carbonated, slightly bitter refreshment that is actually very, when you have a taste for that, you know, that you've developed, is actually really, really pleasing. And, you know, that's one of the times that I can actually enjoy an alcohol-free beer for exactly that reason, if I don't want to consume the alcohol as well. But at the same time, I look at some of the mid-strengths that are around, you know, Heads of Noosa, I've been so excited about. They have got a 3.5% mid-strength lager that is you know, I think world class as a mid-strength lager. You know, certainly as good as any of the you know, major mid-strength lagers. And I would have that because one standard drink, it's out of your body, you know, before you've stood up having finished it. And it's got all of those satisfying things. The alcohol-free beers, on the other hand, because of the way that they're made, they do tend to have more carbs, more, you know, complex sugars that are unfermented, which is the way some of them are made, or even the ones that are made through the vacuum extraction process. Like Heineken, I wrote about it once, Heineken Zero has more carbs than full-strength Heineken because of the way that it's made. And that's just to give it the mouthfeel, because taking alcohol out, you need to replace it with something. And I do wonder whether that technique of making it does give you the more carbs that, you know, when you have it, your body is telling you you're filling up because of the carbs. And then also, let's face it, once you have one beer, that wonderful feeling that alcohol gives us, you know, that very slightly altered feeling of wellness that we're hardwired for. When you have that once, you go chasing that feeling, which is where alcohol is actually quite dangerous, because, you know, we've all had that first beer on a Friday and feel awesome, and then you have the second one and you feel pretty good, and then it's the law of diminishing returns after that.
Yeah.
But you're still chasing that feeling because that's what alcohol does. When you don't have that in an alcohol-free beer, but you do feel that little bit satiated, it's much harder to have a session on.
Now, speaking of Brick Lane, this year's biggest trademark case so far is Brick Lane Sidewinder taking on Better Beer. There's a real obvious likeness with these two products, and I've sort of mistaken one for the other when I've seen them in pictures a couple of times. But I also feel like it's going to be pretty hard, and this is just me speaking from a very much a layperson's
point of view. That's all we can do. We're not lawyers. We're not the court.
Yeah.
You know.
But I feel like it's going to be pretty hard for, you know, for Brick Lane to be able to claim that it was a deliberate move by Better Beer to create another product in the likeness of Sidewinder, because I just think that Sidewinder's been around for 5 minutes anyway. Why would you want to ride on its coattails when you could just create something new and that didn't create any confusion? I feel like it's one of these situations where it's just, you know, it's an unfortunate coincidence, and probably the only winners are going to be the lawyers.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, that is where it's, you know, these things are fascinating. You know, someone's pointed out that both of them look like an Aldi bag. So, you know, that I don't shop at Aldi, so I didn't know that. The language of design, you know, does have a, you know, there are trends and there are fashions, and, you know, one year everyone's wearing brown and orange and every designer is doing in brown and orange. Have they copied each other, or is that just the fashion of the time? And, you know, ultimately we don't know. We weren't in the room, but you can quite easily believe that the design that these breweries came up with when they were designing their products at a similar time, you know, were influenced by the same things, that, you know, the designs were just coincidentally the same, because it's a design, you know, and it's an aesthetic that's very now and very relevant. The one question that Sabrina Kunz raised on our podcast is, well, at some stage, one of them launched first. You know, whether they were developed together, one was developed before the other. At one stage, one was on the market in the wild first. Would it have been smart for whoever was second to have gone, ooh, you know, quite apart from who was first or whatever, there is one on the market. Is it good for us to actually be out there looking the same? Whatever the court decides, the lawyers are going to do well out of it, but you've got two brands that, you know, just from the number of people who have commented on our Facebook page, they've inadvertently bought the other one or things like that. That can't be good for either brand. You could easily change the cans before it becomes too entrenched and still have the beer as successful as it was. And to me, that's the most surprising thing, that nobody has, you know, stepped back. They just have decided to lock horns.
Now, speaking of breweries selling, it was really interesting a few months back to see that Coca-Cola Euro-Pacific Partners, I believe they're now called, is selling Feral Brewing, you know, obviously one of the pioneers of craft beer in Australia, and a company that's certainly brought out, you know, some of the best beers that I've had over many years. Are you hearing anything about what's happening with the sale of Feral Brewing?
No. And look, you know, my first call was to Brendan Varis to see whether he would buy back in. You know, when you look at what happened to Ballast Point, sold for $1 billion to Constellation Brands and then was bought by a tiny little Chicago brew pub called... For cents on the dollar. You sort of wonder whether or not, you know, Brendan might sort of, what was Kerry Packer's line? You know, you only get one Alan Bond in your lifetime, you know. But he assures me that that wasn't going to happen. The astounding thing that came out of that was, weeks before Coca-Cola had announced that they were going to close down the brew pub. You know, you just sort of think, what is the level of sophisticated thought going on in a business when they could have just sold them together and, you know, kept the value?
I would just be, you know, I mean, presumably, and I think they've said that Feral has been in growth since they bought it, but I would just kind of think that, without knowing what Feral sold for last time around, I'd be astonished if they sold for as much as that or more than that. It will be less than that because, you know, what the things that made that brand unique were sort of, you know, the volume of amazing different beers that were coming out and the people that were behind the brand. And just like is probably the case with Four Pure and the other brand that's for sale over in the UK.
Magic Rock, is it?
Yeah, you might build, you know, volume, but some of that value around why a big company wanted them in the first place has kind of been eroded, I think.
The fact that Coke bought it and sold it, whilst it's been in growth, it certainly hasn't been, you know, huge growth. And so that tarnishes the brand. The fact that they've sold the spiritual home just before they announced the sale, they don't even have that they can sort of package. It's a brilliant opportunity for someone to come in and to say, look, I'm going to put this back on track. But nobody's going to buy it for anything near what Coke paid for it, or if they are, you know.
Because it's very risky, basically.
It is very risky, but yeah. It's also a motivated seller. They've basically told everybody they don't want to be in the alcohol business. Even more interesting for me is what happens to Casella. That $65 million Casella brewery, presumably Coke's going to pull out of that. Their investment isn't worth anything because they don't have any brands.
Well, they've got Yenda. Do we know what's happening to Yenda?
Well, they sell off the brand, but it's a brand that seems to only sell because you buy the coffee, you buy the, you know, the spirits. It's one of those brands that is only ever ranged at somebody who has commercial agreements, so they can't have a lot of volume to it.
And it was always a bit of a strange kind of choice for a brand. I forget who it was in the industry that made the point to me that, you know, normally when you get these kind of place names,
it's Byron Bay or Yamundi,
it's Byron Bay. It's like somewhere that you go on holiday. I mean, I love taking a case of Yenda home with me when I go to Yenda on holiday.
Exactly. And you know, so there was just such low level. Oh, yeah, one of the things that makes me laugh is whenever you sort of question business types, and I'm not a business type, you know, I'm a journalist, but, you know, it's always, oh, you know, these are smart people. And then you look at some of the stupid decisions that they make, or some of the ones that to an outsider seem stupid and history subsequently proves are stupid. You go, some of them aren't that smart, you know. So, look, who knows? But I'm really interested to see what happens there, because you've got this expensive brewery that sits on Casella land. What's going to happen to that?
Now, a brewery in your general neck of the woods, Black Hops, I've just seen, is going out to the market for its second equity crowdfunding raise. Is it second, or is it, they haven't?
Oh, mate, they've done every flavour of, you know, they've got sophisticated private, you know, they've done, they when they first were opening their first brewery and they needed a canning line, they did a traditional crowdfund, not even an equity crowdfund. It's just, we need 17 grand for our bottling line, or our canning line, you know, who wants to, you know, get a 10% discount for whatever it was. So they've had every type of, short of a sale, they've sort of done about just about everything. And it was interesting, I read something that Dan Norris said, you know, we're not looking for sophisticated money this time, We're just sort of looking for people who love the brand and want to invest in it, which to me is the people who will pay over the odds and not ask questions.
There's obviously been a whole stack of these equity crowdfunding deals now. I mean, we must be somewhere around, there must have been something like 15 of them, I'd say, in the last few years. Has anyone done a health check on this model of funding and sort of whether it is delivering investors any sort of return or whether it's good for breweries as well?
Yeah.
You know, is it a good path to go down?
By and large, the people that I've spoken to that have invested in the more recent equity crowd funds, they're happy. Like they, you know, it's money they can afford to lose. It's, you know, $500, $1,000, $2,000, and they feel part of something. And they're people who love the brand that they've invested in, or they just love the craft beer industry. I know people that have invested in just about everything. And so they've, you know, they've seen it all. You're going, well, God, you know, take up golf. It's a cheaper hobby than, you know, equity crowdfunding. But they love it. And so you can't take anything away from the people who feel, you know, it's just like backing a horse race. You know, you're much more interested in watching the horses go around, you know, an oval if you've got money on it. And if that's your motivation, that's fine. I always just come back to it though, if that's the reason that breweries point to for people investing in them, why do they sell it as an investment? You know, what it's always marketed as an investment and very, very heavily. So, you know, we had a bit of a chat before Christmas with a couple of, you know, a hotel broker, a finance expert, and Matt Vitale from Birchall. And, you know, it was interesting how defensive Matt was about, you know, I've read he was about the, you know, what equity crowdfunding is, and he talked about the Brave New World, and it was all the hype. Nobody was trying to justify the actual valuations. And when you look at what the dollar valuations they put on these breweries for their worth as an investment, and then you see what any brewery that is actually ever put on the market for sale outside of the ones that are highly desirable to the big brewers, the actual sale price for a brewery, they're not even in the same country. So that's my criticism that they're sold as investments.
One thing I was keen to ask you about is latest info in the brewery database, which Brews News started working on last year. Now, there are 700-plus breweries in Australia, aren't there, Matt? Yours says it's a significantly lower number than that. Can you enlighten us as to why that is and tell us how many breweries there actually are in Australia?
Yeah, mate, this is one of our COVID pivots. You know, again, it was something that you and I talked about when you were editing Brews News. Whenever you see any brewery starting, any brewery looking for funding or anything like that, you know, they quote growth figures saying that there are 800 breweries, and then they source to a couple of websites that, you know, you only have to look at it for 2 minutes and you see breweries that you know have closed down, you know, have gone broke. And, you know, on these databases, breweries only ever open. They never really close. And if you're just a brand, you know, there's no for sale sign or for lease sign. You just stop making beer one day, but your social media profile is there. End of the world, it looks like there's a brewery, and there's just not. So, you know, it was a problem that you and I discussed, and over COVID, we had a bit of time to actually go through and do it. It was a major project, you know, scanning all of these competing lists and trying to find breweries and trying to divine if they're not responding to their emails, whether it was open. But in the end, you know, there are 563 physical stainless steel breweries. Our next plan is to come up with a number of brands. How many brands are there? Because in terms of the size of the industry and the level of investment in stainless, the number of breweries is a meaningful figure. In terms of competition in the marketplace, you really do need to include the Bondi Brewings and the Lord Howe Brewings and the, up until now, the Hawks Brewing, which is a brand, but, you know, is going to build a brewery. And, you know, I think there's a nice progression there, but that creates a whole level of other complication. There's no VB Brewery, but there's a VB brand. It's one of the biggest in the world. You know, there is, as much as they wish there was, there is no Great Northern Brewery, biggest beer brand in Australia. You know, you've got the CUB Yatala Brewery that's in our database. You've got the Abbotsford Brewery that's in our database. But how do you, you know, how do you count that as a, you know, it's technically a brand. It's not actually a brewery. So, you know, where does that fall when you've got, you know, like a Lord Howe Island Brewing Company that is a contract brewed beer, but it's only one business and one brand. What do you do when you've got a CUB or a Lion that has, you know, and Lion's got fewer breweries now since they closed South Australia, but, you know, so there isn't a West End brewery anymore. There isn't a, it's technically a brand in the same way that some of the contract brands are, or, you know, and that's a really, really hard thing for how you count brands. And then you've got the supermarket brands and you've got all of these other things. So it's a really, really hard one that we're still trying to work through. How do we count it?
Now tell me about the other project, the Brewers Network.
You can go to half the breweries in Australia and speak to the brewer, and they've come through Malt Shovel or Little Creatures or Gage Roads, and you just sort of think, well, you know, what's the most influential brewery in terms of training brewers? You know, what are the linkages between, you know, how many brewers have been at different, you know, some of the longer running craft breweries? And, you know, how many degrees of separation are there from brewer to brewer? You know, what's your Bacon number? You know, that 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. It seemed far too big a project for us to do until I started just, you know, I just wanted to just have conversation. Wouldn't this be awesome if we could do this? And suddenly we had Little Creatures, as they were celebrating their 21st birthday, said, hey, that's a great idea. We'd love to know. You know, how about we give you some seed money to actually get it started, and, you know, and then we'll sort of step back, but we've created something as part of our 21st birthday. And we're going to start publishing the first level of results. And I think we've got about 200 brewers have completed already. If you're a brewer that's listening to this, jump on, fill out the form, just find it on Brewers News. But it'll be a really, really interesting data set for how connected the Australian brewing industry is. And, you know, as you know, industry data is the hardest thing. And we were hoping that this was such a cool idea that brewers would want to be involved in it. They would want to see their, you know, careers reflected on a database. And so we also added just some industry basic questions like, you know, what gender do you identify with? How old are you? What level of qualifications have you attained? Where did you study? What nationality are you? So we can at least just come up with some anonymized demographic data. Last year we had the Rat Magnet stuff in the US that, you know, of course had an impact in Australia and had people asking questions, but there was no data to point to what is the diversity in the industry. You know, how diverse is it? What do we need to correct? And that was the nice thing about announcing this project. The number of people that contacted us and said, this is awesome, this data is going to be so valuable, quite apart from the cool little graphic of connections, hopefully we can establish some really valuable data as a baseline for the industry.
While I've got you there, what breweries and beers are currently exciting you? You mentioned Heads of Noosa before, but anyone else in particular that you've really been enjoying over the summer?
Well, I'll just give a little bit more of Heads of Noosa because, you know, this is a brewery that started in Noosa on the Sunshine Coast 5 or 6 years ago when there were still, you know, hops and IPAs and, you know, cans were really the hype thing, and they created a German lager brewery on the Sunshine Coast that bottled its beers. And, you know, if anybody is swimming against every current when they launched, and you sort of had, you know, conventional wisdom said, you know, you guys are doing everything wrong, they flourished. Their beer is, for lagers, is just bang on. It's competing with the majors. They found a niche with bottles in a time when everyone else wants it, because it's a sort of beer that places that stock bottles wants to have. So, you know, to me, they are somebody that a lot of brewers should be stepping back and looking at, because there is just so much bandwagon jumping and me-tooing, you know, me-tooing in the I'm going to do that as well, you know, sense, and I need to have a hazy, I need to have all of this. And the breweries that are really exciting me at the moment are the ones that are going, this is what we want to be. We don't want to try and compete with the entire market. And if we have to be a brewery that grows much more slowly than some of the other breweries around us, then so be it. And they're the breweries that are really, you know, really, really exciting me. There's a Madoc on the Gold Coast that's making Belgian beer, and we're seeing two or three breweries in Australia making Belgian beer. And I think, again, another thing that swimming against the tide a little bit, but you know, maybe something that we'll find its time. You know, everyone's excited about Wildflower. he's doing some really, really exciting stuff, and a couple of others are doing that sort of thing as well. It's people that seem to have their own idea of where their lane ropes are, and they're staying in their lane, are the ones that really, really excite me at the moment. They're certainly the ones that raise the most interest in me in terms of following them to see how they go.
Now, tell me what's happening at your podcast, Radio Brews News, because I tuned in last week and the prof, Pete Mitchum, was conspicuously absent.
Look, Pete and I have been doing the podcast. It was the first beer podcast in Australia, going since 2011. And, you know, last year I had to sit back, you know, when it was you, me and Pete doing a podcast, you know, not a lot of diversity. You know, you're a little bit younger than us, but, you know, still, you know, not a lot of diversity in an industry that has recognised the need for, you know, a wider array of viewpoints. And I'm incredibly lucky at Brews News. The senior journalist, Claire Burnett, is a 30-year-old young woman with a background in business, journalism, and brings a vastly different perspective than I do. We've got a cadet journalist who's 24, doesn't drink, which is very reflective of the broader market. And the questions that Vivian asks are ones that I probably wouldn't do, and her perspective about it are very, very different. And so in the podcast, that was what we wanted to try and capture. Pete and I have been doing it for a long time. The industry's changed. The idea was that we were going to rotate he and I in, so it wasn't two, 50-something white blokes who, you know, everyone knows their opinions. And Sabrina had moved to Brisbane, Sabrina Kunz, who was the former chair of the Brewers Guild of New Zealand and somebody who I'd had a lot of contact with, and got her on for one podcast, and she put me in my place, did exactly what we wanted, you know, brought in a different viewpoint, and made me concede, you know, a number of points. The audience seemed to like mum and dad having a fight in front of them, but then also the fresh viewpoint. And I'm still waiting to see what Sabrina's perception is, and, you know, what her thinking is. But if she wants to be on it more, we'd love to have it. And if that means I'm one less, I'm quite happy with that as well.
Fantastic. Well, if you've enjoyed this conversation with Matt, then make sure you tune into Radio Brews News. Matt, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Oh, mate, thank you. And congratulated you on our podcast, but I'll congratulate you on your own for winning the first multi-award winning beer writer in the country, and all of the accolades that your Drinks Adventures podcast has done. You know, it's you've really built something very substantial, and congratulations for that.
Thanks, mate.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at By James Atkinson, like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.